Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
Doctors at a Canadian hospital have discovered something new about the human brain. They were trying to treat an obese man with a procedure using electrodes called deep brain stimulation when something remarkable happened. Professor Andres Lozano was one of the doctors involved.
As we were introducing the electrodes in the hypothalamus, and as we first started to run some currents through the electrode, he was able to recall an event that had occurred 30 years earlier. And so we knew immediately that this was something quite extraordinary.
What exactly do you mean by that? It was a very vivid memory?
Well, it was as if we had unlocked a memory of an event that had occurred 3 decades earlier. He reported that he had a sensation of déjà vu, a sensation where he was in a park with his friends. He recognized his girlfriend at that epoch. He saw their clothes. He could see the colors. He could hear certain words that they were saying. He could tell that it was a sunny day and so on. And remarkably, as we increased the current, the richness of the experience increased. It became more vivid.
So you did this a second time?
Well, we stopped stimulating. We moved along. We went back to the same place. And again, as soon as we turned it on at a certain intensity, we provoked exactly the same scene, the same memory. We stimulated in several places, and we found that if there was a memory provoked, it was always the same event, the same scene in the hypothalamus.
How important was that scene to that fellow's life? What was so significant about that memory?
It wasn't particularly a significant memory. He had no control. He could not, you know, change the channels and change to another scene or another event in his life. It was locked.
That ability to unlock that memory using electrical stimulation, what does this tell you about how our brains work?
Well, it tells us that, you know, we know very little about the circuitry of memory in humans. And it tells us that these circuits can be accessed. We feel like we're driving the activity or turning up the volume quite high with the current, and this is indeed producing a spontaneous recollection of a past event.
What kind of benefit might that provide to patients who have memory disorders?
Well, we feel that if we can safely reach these circuits in the brain that regulate memory, and as we've shown in this particular one case, that one can drive the activity of these circuits, then we may also be able to access these circuits and increase their activity in patients with memory disorders. What we don't know is whether we'll be able to take someone with diseased circuits in the brain as an Alzheimer's disease and enhance memory under those circumstances, and that's why we're doing a study.
A technical question. You're talking about electrodes that are implanted in the brain even while a patient is awake. How are you able to do that?
The patients are operated under local anesthesia, and this procedure that we're doing is exactly the same one that we do for Parkinson's disease. And I should let you know that approximately 40,000 humans with Parkinson's disease already have these electrodes in place.
Boy, this sounds like a remarkable moment of accidental discovery for you. When you realized what you had done, that you could actually control the vividness of that memory, what was that like for you?
Well, it was a eureka moment for us. We knew it was something extraordinary, something totally unanticipated. My personal philosophy in science is that the best discoveries are always serendipitous. And I think this is an example where we were looking for something and didn't find it, but instead we found something that was interesting and we pursued it. And we hope that it may lead to a better understanding of how memory works in the brain and how one day we may use this knowledge to improve memory function.
Congratulations to you, Dr. Lozano. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That's Professor Andres Lozano at the Toronto Western Research Institute.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. Traumatic brain injury has been labeled the signature injury of the Iraq War. Now, a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine finds that even minor brain injuries, concussions, are associated with long-term health problems, specifically post-traumatic stress disorder. NPR's Elise Spiegel has the story.
Army medic Tim Bredberg's first concussion happened during a routine patrol through the Iraq desert. It was late afternoon when the road he was on narrowed abruptly, creating a bottleneck more or less in the middle of nowhere.
We were going through this, and two other vehicles went before us, and we're thinking, okay, we're safe. And we drove by it, and then the next thing I know, I wake up in the middle of a firefight.
Besides a concussion, Bredberg was unhurt. For 2 days, he says his ears rang and his eyes were sensitive to light, but there were no other symptoms. And Bredberg says he didn't really feel rattled by the experience in any real way.
Not that I noticed. If anything, I was more pissed off and wanted to get out there even faster.
Over the course of his time in Iraq, Bredberg was hit by IEDs 3 other times and suffered another concussion. But again, he didn't notice any lasting effects. But then Bredberg returned to the U.S. and he began having nightmares. Dreams of violence so intense he didn't want to sleep. Bredberg says he would startle at the slightest noise. There were flashbacks and wild mood swings. His relationships began to deteriorate. He found it difficult even to be near his infant son.
I couldn't be around my son because of flashbacks when he cried.
But perhaps the scariest moment came one weekend when Bredberg was out at a store. A man passed him, and Bredberg remembers him saying something vaguely rude.
Next thing I know, I have people from this grocery store yelling at me and grabbing at me because I'm beating the hell out of this guy in the parking lot. And I didn't realize it. I didn't know I was doing it.
Bredberg finally went to mental health on his base at Fort Drum. He says he was told by the doctors there that he had PTSD. Now a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine suggests that there may be a relationship between concussions and the development of post-traumatic stress disorder. Army medical researcher Charles Hoag surveyed over 2,000 Army infantry soldiers who had returned from Iraq and found that 3 to 4 months after their return, a high percentage of those who had experienced a concussion met the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder.
Nearly half of soldiers who had a concussion with loss of consciousness met the criteria for PTSD, and that's a very high rate.
Hoag says he was a little surprised by these results because in the civilian world, concussions aren't generally associated with PTSD.
For instance, on a football field, football players certainly don't develop post-traumatic stress disorder in the context of football injuries and concussions on the football field.
Hoag says one possible explanation is that traumatic battles produce both concussions and PTSD. But another researcher, David Havda, a professor of neurosurgery at UCLA, suggests another possibility. He points out that there are real chemical changes in the brain in the wake of a concussion.
And this change in chemistry causes other things to change, which have long-term consequences with regards to how the brain responds to emotions.
So, says Havda, though concussions don't cause post-traumatic stress disorder, the chemical changes that are the product of concussion and the lethargy, anxiety, and depression that often follow may inhibit a person's ability to recover from a traumatic experience. 3.5 years after his return from Iraq, Tim Bredberg continues his fight with the disease, but says he is somewhat better able to cope with his child's crying.
It is getting a little bit better. I mean, I could be around him for a certain amount of time. If he cries, like if I feel myself hitting a flashback when I'm around him, I can control it to a point. Just repeating to myself that, you know, everything's okay. My wife's in the other room. I'm sitting in the bathroom. You know, just keep going through things like that.
Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
You'll need sustenance to get through the big game today, so don't forget the chips and your favorite dip, whether it be guacamole, salsa, bean, or cheese. But do not dip that chip twice. Paul Dawson, a professor of food microbiology at Clemson University, and his students conducted a recent study on the dangers of double dipping. The research was inspired by an episode of Seinfeld.
Did you just double dip that chip?
Excuse me?
You double dipped the chip.
Double dipped? What are you talking about?
You dipped the chip, you took a bite, and you dipped again.
So?
That's like putting your whole mouth right in the dip.
Paul Dawson joins us from Clemson University. First, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
What did you expect to find in your research on double dipping?
I expected not to find very much bacteria transferred, but we were surprised that when the student dipped the chip and then put it back in the dip, it does inoculate, so to speak, that common dip area.
Hmm. What dips did you use to test your theory?
We started with actually sterile water just to see if it would transfer, and when it did, we tested 3 dips, that being salsa, chocolate dip, and then cheese dip. And sure enough, it followed suit that there was significant transfer of bacteria due to double dipping.
Is it really more or less sanitary than kissing somebody or sharing a toothbrush?
I would say it's about the same, and most bacteria are good bacteria, are not harmful. On the other hand, we know that there are infectious diseases that are carried in saliva. It only follows that this might be another way that those are transferred.
So what's the solution for folks who are going to have their Super Bowl parties today? Should they just steer clear of particular dips?
Well, you said a couple of things earlier that one would be you look around the room, and if people are double dipping, if you're willing to kiss everybody in the room, then go ahead. Or if you prefer not to, then maybe avoid that dip.
All right. Are you doing anything Super Bowl Sunday?
I've actually been invited over for some other colleagues to have a Super Bowl party, yes.
What are you going to
check? I'll be bringing some sanitizer and, I think we're bringing some dip.
What kind of dip are you bringing?
Spinach artichoke dip.
Uh-huh.
Small chips, rubber gloves.
and antibiotics.
Toothbrush, yeah.
Paul Dawson is a professor of food microbiology at Clemson University in South Carolina. His study on double dipping will be published later this year in the Journal of Food Safety. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. It could become the biggest medical facility in the Middle East. Construction is underway on the first phase of the International Medical Center in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. It focuses on issues critical to health care in the region, and in the coming years it will include a nursing school and a medical college. NPR's Peter Kenyon paid a visit.
The first impression one gets of the International Medical Center is the cool, spacious reception area. There is no crush of patients and family members trying to figure out where to go, just a high-ceilinged, marble-covered room with huge windows looking out onto a leafy garden. Behind the garden is a mosque. Marketing director Adil Shaban says this is part of the founder's approach to healing, and while it may seem extravagant and cost inefficient, he says the center is seeing positive results.
You know, I was talking to Dr. Khaled yesterday, telling him that every square meter counts in a hospital because this is a profit-generating private hospital. So basically investing in a garden would not seem to be the best logical thing. But yes, it really promotes healing. It really decreases the time that a person will stay in a hospital. So the average stay in the hospital is less at this hospital than other benchmarks in the region.
The center was founded as a partnership with the Cleveland Clinic, ranked by U.S. News & World Report as one of America's best hospitals. A distinctive feature of the center here in Jeddah is its willingness to combine traditional medicine with alternative treatments such as reflexology. Every new hire is introduced to the center's philosophy of healing mind, body, and soul. Traditional medicine is hardly shortchanged here, however. The center incorporates cutting-edge medical technology with some innovative design features. Shaban points out one small example in the intensive care unit, where each nursing station has a window into two rooms.
Now here, as you see in the ICU, it's the biggest in the Middle East. And as you know, there's a, I think it's a worldwide crisis in terms of nursing. And what we have here is a very beautiful system that one nurse can watch over two patients in the same time without diverting the attention on one patient more than the other.
No expense seems to have been spared at the International Medical Center, which Shaban hopes will lead Saudis to look here for first-class health care instead of traveling abroad. But the opulence also raises the obvious question. Will only wealthy Saudis and foreigners be able to afford to come here? Former journalist Khaled Al-Batarfi, now with the center's public relations department, says the founders established a multi-million-dollar fund to subsidize health care for the poor.
Another part of our mission here is to help the needy. And that's why the partners of this organization put a fund. If somebody are unable to pay part of his bill, we'll cover that for him. If he couldn't pay anything, we'll still heal them.
On the other hand, this is not an altruistic enterprise. One of the six centers of excellence at the International Medical Center is the highly lucrative field of cosmetic surgery. A more important area of focus, however, may be diabetes, which Adil Shaban says is plaguing the kingdom.
Because, as you know, the prevalence of diabetes in Saudi Arabia is the highest in the world. One of every four people over 25 years old is either pre-diabetic or diabetic. So that's a very high ratio. So diabetes is one of the centers of excellence that we have.
In the coming years, plans call for a nursing school, medical college, and an 85-story hotel, and perhaps additional medical centers in Riyadh and Dubai. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jeddah.
50 years ago today, the U.S. launched its first satellite, and the space race with the Soviet Union was on. To hear the story, NPR's Richard Harris paid a visit to the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C.
In a display hall filled with wonders like Skylab, the lunar lander, and the Apollo-Soyuz spacecraft, it's easy to overlook a small glass case with a modest rocket-shaped thing inside it. But the museum's chief space historian, Michael Neufeld, says this 30-pound object holds a special place in space history.
This is a backup of Explorer 1, the first United States satellite that was launched on January 31, 1958.
And being an historian, Neufeld is excited to tell the backstory of the space race. 4 months earlier, the Soviets had built a rocket that was able to carry Sputnik 1 into orbit. It was the first man-made satellite.
The first Sputnik achievement was followed 1 month later, less than 1 month later, by Sputnik 2 with a dog Laika. And that was a real shock because the payload was so large.
The message was loud and clear. If the Soviets could lob a dog around the world, imagine what else long-range rockets could carry.
We would never have invested all this money in rocket technology, nor would the Soviets, if we weren't fundamentally trying to find a way to loft a warhead thousands of miles.
Neufeld says the U.S. had been urgently working on its own space program, but it was running a bit behind the Soviets. And the first attempt to catch up came in December 1957. The Navy tried to launch a satellite with a rocket it was developing.
And it's a humiliating failure. It goes up a few inches, engine cuts off, falls back, explodes, and dumps a satellite out on the scrubland. And in fact, over here in another case, we have the satellite.
The Navy got to work trying to figure out what was up with its rocket program, and that gave its rival, the Army space program, a chance to put America into orbit. Wernher von Braun had adopted the German V-2 rocket used in World War II, and at 10:48 p.m. on January 31st, the Army launched his rocket. On top was the Explorer 1 satellite. It left the Earth and went off into, well, von Braun and his colleagues didn't know exactly where it went.
They were at the Pentagon waiting, and it went around the world and didn't show up on time. Well, it turns out it went into a higher orbit than planned, so it was 8 minutes late. And for 8 minutes, they were all feeling doomed.
They called a press conference in the wee hours of the morning to announce their success.
U.S. national honor had been saved. It was such an enormous relief for the American public that we'd finally done it after 4 months of, you know, feeling like a second-rate space power.
And Explorer 1 wasn't just a symbolic mission. It did some exciting science. It discovered the radiation belts around the Earth in magnetic fields that prevent us from being fried by charged particles from the sun. And as the space age blossomed, many other science experiments followed as a sideline to the ballistic missiles, the development of spy satellites, and the manned space program.
We accelerated incredibly from this little satellite to putting a human on the moon in 1969, only 12 years. It was really astounding. One of the interesting things about it, however, is that we haven't gone nearly as far as the space true believers like Wernher von Braun thought we would. You know, by now we thought we'd have Mars colonies and who knows what.
And at the current rate, Neufeld says, we'll be celebrating the 50th anniversary of our first man on the moon 11 years from now with a repeat of that mission. Richard Harris, NPR News.
In your health today, tuna and concerns over mercury contamination. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports on the results of some new independent tests on samples of fish bought at grocery stores and restaurants and what they mean for sushi lovers.
Market analysis shows health-conscious young professionals are big on sushi. And as palates evolve, raw fish seems to be making its way into the mainstream, with about one-third of consumers now describing sushi as appealing.
Here's a lot of packaged fresh sushi in a grocery store.
Marine scientist Kimberly Warner stands at the grab-and-go counter at a busy Washington, D.C. market.
Yeah, we see a lot of salmon, eel. Here's a spicy tuna roll.
There's a lot of tuna, from the Tokyo Roll to the Rainbow Roll, and Warner's Marine Conservation Group, called Oceana, recently tested samples for mercury contamination. They purchased tuna and sushi from groceries and restaurants in 23 cities around the country, then they shipped it off to an independent certified lab in Michigan.
We found very high levels of mercury in nearly half the samples.
And what does that mean? How high is high?
Well, most of those approached the FDA action level, and we're above the level that we find in fish that the FDA warns the sensitive groups to avoid.
Sensitive groups mean women who are pregnant, thinking of becoming pregnant, as well as nursing mothers and young children. They're advised by the FDA to avoid four types of fish known to have higher levels of mercury, including swordfish, shark, tilefish, and king mackerel. The reason is that mercury at high enough levels can harm a developing fetus and cause problems with brain development. Tuna is not included on this do-not-eat list. The FDA's toxicologist, Mike Bulger, says they've tested many types of tuna, including the popular sushi and steak-grade yellowfin tuna.
We've heard people say that these tend to have higher levels. And every time we've looked at it, we have not been able to confirm that to be the case.
In 2006, the FDA tested only 87 samples of yellowfin. Oceana and other independent testers have sampled even fewer. Since there's a lot of variation from species to species and even fish to fish, these tests may not be representative of the supply at large. The FDA's Mike Bulger says he has not reviewed the Oceana study, but he says if there is a pattern of high mercury concentration, he'll look at it.
Probably as a minimal effort, the step would be to go out and get some more samples of yellowfin to see where we are in terms of that particular fish and what's in the marketplace right now.
Bulger says the FDA has not evaluated bluefin tuna. Bluefin is the prized, expensive species served in high-end sushi restaurants. Independent tests suggest high mercury levels.
We have not looked at bluefin because it's such a minor species.
It's minor by percentage of seafood sales, totaling less than 1%. But the National Marine Fisheries Database shows about $19 million worth of bluefin was imported to the U.S. in the last 2 years. So it's clear that some Americans are eating bluefin. Gavin Gibbons represents the National Fisheries Institute. He says the mercury in bluefin, or any other fish, should not be of concern to most consumers. He reminds it's women of childbearing age and their young children who are the target of the advisories. And even for them, only a handful of fish are to be avoided.
The general public should be encouraged to continue eating a variety of fish and knowing that it is a very safe part of a healthy American diet.
It's a message echoed by nutritionists and researchers who've shown that the omega-3 fatty acids found in fish are very beneficial. The strategy for women of childbearing age, experts say, is to make informed choices. That's why groups such as Oceana say the FDA needs to increase the frequency of its testing for commonly consumed fish. Allison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
You can get the government's full recommendations on what fish are safe to eat. Bluefish could be a problem. Looking here at the list, haddock is fine. So are anchovies. You can get it all at our website, npr.org/yourhealth.